In this part of the show, we'll be talking about the automobile industry, and particularly about what's happening with the American auto companies, the big three. And our guest for the program is Michelin Maynard. She covers the auto and airline industries for The New York Times. And she's the author of a book that's just recently been published titled The End of Detroit, How the Big Three Lost Their Grip on the American Car Market. It is published by Doubleday. It's out now in the bookstore. And in case you had any doubt about where she comes down, I'll just read you one sentence, the first sentence of the first chapter in the book. It is, Detroit's long reign as the dominant force in the American car industry is over. We'll be talking about how and why that happened in this part of Focus. Questions, of course, are welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Certainly anyone listening is welcome to call with a question. All we ask of callers is that people are brief. We ask that so we can keep the program moving and get in as many people as possible. Again, 333-WILL, toll-free, 800-222-WILL. Ms. Maynard, hello.
Hi, good morning, I guess I should say.
I guess it's still morning here. Thanks very much for talking with us.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Actually, I would love to listen tomorrow when John Sinclair is on because I'm a big admirer of his, too.
Well, you can hear us online.
Okay.
We also have a web archive, so you can go back and hear the show.
Great.
Just to sort of establish where things are here with the American automakers, I would make reference to something that just happened recently, and you wrote about it for the paper. This happened, I guess we're talking about the month of August, and here the lead on the story is very clear, where you and your co-author here write, the day that the American automobile industry has been dreading for years arrived today. This was dated September 3rd. Mm-hmm. Toyota outsold Chrysler in the month of August. That was the first time that one of Detroit's big three has fallen to fourth place.
Yes.
A major milestone in U.S. auto history.
Well, it's very interesting because, I've been working on this book for most of the last 2 years. I actually got the idea for it right after the 9/11 attacks, unfortunately. And I had thought at some point Toyota would pass Chrysler. I just didn't think it would be this soon. And really, that was a wake-up call for the entire industry on basically what's happened with consumers and what's happened with the car market. I mean, I admit that the timing couldn't be better for my book, but even I am not that much of a prophet.
Well, you do make some predictions, and among them that you think that it is very likely that by the end of the decade, Toyota will be the world's largest car company.
Yes, Toyota, Toyota's not very happy. I don't think that I've written about that in my book because, they've tried to keep as low a profile as they can, but their goal is to have 15% of the global car market by 2010. And basically now General Motors has a little bit over 15%, and that figure has been dropping. One of the reasons is that for one thing, its American market share has dropped, and also its market share in Europe has dropped, where Toyota has gained sales in the United States and in Europe, as well as hanging on to its home market in Japan. So I don't want people to think it's only based on the United States. It's sort of a footprint in all the major areas of the world.
And among other, the other list of things that you predict is that you think that perhaps, again, by the end of the decade, one of the big three, one of the U.S. big three automakers, will not continue in its present form. And I'm not exactly sure what that means, if it would be no more, or it would perhaps two of them would merge to form one company.
Well, you're right on the money. And in fact, there's been a lot of talk over the summer about a possible bankruptcy at one of the car companies. And I want to make it very clear, I don't think that's going to happen, although it isn't beyond the realm of possibility. Since I cover the airline industry as well as the auto industry, I've seen what's happened with United, for example. So I guess nothing can be ruled out anymore. What I really mean is that it's quite likely that one or two of the companies could see their market share decline even further than it has. And we could easily turn out to have a market like Europe, where you have one major company with, say, 20 to 25% market share, and then everybody else carves everything up. But I don't think we'll see a time again when the three Detroit companies are the three dominant companies.
Well, it's just to toss out one more set of numbers here, you think that it's also likely that by, again, at the same time frame we're talking about, by the end of the decade, that the U.S. auto market could be evenly divided between U.S. automakers and imports, that is, of the cars sold, half would be Detroit and half would be imports.
Right. We'll probably end this year with the imports holding about 40 to 40.5% of the market, which would be their biggest amount ever. And that's the entire car market. You know, if you were to back out sales by the Detroit companies to their employees and friends and families, and also their sales to the rental car companies, we might even be at 50-50 now in the retail market.
Hmm. Well, when you asked the question, why is it this happened? You have a number of things, sort of basic points that you say, you know, why did this happen? And it seems that, let's talk about the, maybe take those things one by one. And you say the first is that one of the things that the import, the foreign companies did was that they really spent a lot of time thinking about, talking to, trying to find out what American drivers wanted and responded to that in a way that the U.S. companies had never done. Their way of doing things simply was to make the product and say, okay, here it is, take it or leave it, and to spend a lot of time thinking about marketing rather than building the best car that they possibly could. What you say is the foreign companies, what they decided to do was most important. The top thing on the list was building the best car that they could build, and that strategy for them was very successful.
Well, one of the reasons they had to do that was that they don't have the broad range of dealerships that the Detroit companies have, nor are their lineups as broad. And in the past, that was thought of as something of a drawback. But today, I think as the market gets more and more cluttered with vehicles, that's not a bad place to be. And, you know, there is a parallel between the airline industry and the auto industry where, you know, in the airline industry you have the major companies and then you have the Southwests and the JetBlues, which are nipping at the heels of the major companies, and now we'll have 25% of airline passengers by the end of this year. I think that Detroit offers a broad array of products. In my class at the University of Michigan, we talk about Sloan and his theory of a car for every person purpose. And that, for the first 70 years or so of the auto industry, was the prevailing wisdom. When the Japanese companies came here first, they couldn't afford to offer broad arrays of vehicles. Then, you know, they didn't have the dealers to do that. And then as they went forward, they kind of could see where that was tripping up Detroit. So instead of filling slots, you know, instead of it being a big supermarket of cars, it's been more like a boutique of cars, and they're adding, you know, they're adding space and tearing down walls to make their boutiques bigger. But on the other hand, their thinking hasn't changed. They just don't think they have to be all things to all people.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's also interesting that you argue that what happened was, particularly, I guess this happened in the 90s, when American car makers became so enthusiastic about the SUV and put so much of their resources, and particularly I think Ford did this, so much of their resources into SUVs and into trucks, that there still were other kinds of, that there were people who did want other kinds of cars, and that the imports said,
cars
we can
still
do that.
Half of the car market.
Yeah.
Sorry to step on you, it was very interesting to watch. You know, SUVs at this point are 25% of the car market. And I don't blame the Detroit companies for going where the profits are. They really needed to shore up their operations in the 90s. But it was sort of like that old coffee commercial where they announced that coffee's being served on the right-hand side of the ship, and all the passengers go to the right-hand side of the ship, and it starts to tip over into the water. I think they put too much emphasis. You know, Detroit never does things in a balanced way, and you know, there's always sort of a search for the magic solution, and they decided it was SUVs in the late 90s, and that was what they focused on. Mm.
So then the imports realized that there were other, that people did want cars, they wanted other kinds of vehicles, they could serve that market. And then to add insult to injury, what they did to the U.S. automakers was they saw the demand for SUVs and trucks, and they said, well, we can make those. And they started, and I think now For the first time fairly recently, there is an import maker that's making a full-size truck, Toyota.
Right. Well, not only Toyota, but this winter Nissan will introduce the Nissan Titan, and I tell that story in my book. And that is even bigger than anything Toyota's ever done. And everyone in Detroit is watching the Titan. You know, they're trying to be really confident about it and say, oh, nobody's going to want to buy it. And that we still have our big F-Series Ford trucks and our big GMC trucks. But the thing is, success for Nissan in the truck market doesn't have to be a million units. It just has to be about 100,000. And if they only get their own customers who own a Ford or a GM pickup truck to come in and trade it in for a Nissan, that's success for them. And they've taken 100,000 sales away from one of the other companies.
And it seems that as far as Ford is concerned, I think, isn't it the truck that's kind of the thing that's keeping them in business?
Pretty much. I mean, and I have to hand it to Ford. There's a new version of the F-150 pickup that just came out this fall. They're spending $100 million on advertising it. They spent probably $1 billion or more on this new truck. And that's, you know, that's exactly what Detroit has to do to fight back on the imports. The problem is they simply can't afford to do that with every single vehicle, and yet that is probably what they need to fight off the imports. I'd like to make one more point about the sort of market for light trucks. One of the ways that the Japanese especially have made inroads on Detroit is in the minivan market. And I'm sure you'll remember that Chrysler minivans were what everybody bought. They're built down in St. Louis, and they were the standard for the first sort of 13 or 14 years of the minivan market. The Japanese minivans just weren't suitable for America. Well, Honda in the mid-90s decided that it wanted to set out to build the best minivan ever. And the chief engineer of that minivan came to the United States and spent 6 months driving all over the country and meeting customers and talking to children and figuring out how to build a better minivan. And when 1992, the Big Three had 94% of minivan sales in this country, and now, thanks to Honda and to the new Toyota minivan, that's down to 70%. So they've lost one quarter of the minivan market in just the last 10 years.
Let me introduce again our guest, Micheline Maynard. She covers the automobile and airline industries for the New York Times. She's also written for Fortune and USA Today, Newsday, U.S. News and World Report. She's also a lecturer on the global auto industry at the University of Michigan School of Business and is the author of two books, including Collision Course, Inside the Battle for General Motors. Her new book is titled The End of Detroit, How the Big Three Lost Their Grip on the American Car Market. It's just out. It's published by Doubleday. Questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. There's another change that you talk about in the book that I think for a long time one of the advantages that the American automakers had was that there were a lot of Americans who felt that they wanted to buy an American car. You know, for them it was an issue of, it was an issue of patriotism and supporting American industry, and that just wouldn't, the idea of buying a Japanese or a German car just wasn't on. And that's something, if you look at the attitudes of people, and particularly I guess it's attitudes of younger car buyers, when people who are out there buying maybe their first car, they don't seem to have any problem with buying a car that was made by a foreign company. Of course, nowadays you can buy Japanese cars that are made in the United States, but it's for them the fact that it's a Japanese company rather than a Detroit company, they don't have a problem with that.
Well, that was really sent home to me after September 11th. General Motors rolled out a program that was literally called Keep America Rolling, and that made 0% financing available to a wide variety of people. But when the dust settled, when all of the sales were in, it turned out that the import companies had actually gained market share. At a time when you thought our country would have been at its most patriotic, people were still buying more imports. So one of the things that I wanted to find out was why. And I've interviewed dozens of customers. And, you know, I got out of Detroit to write this book. I spent 3 months in Japan, and I've traveled to all the new factories across the country. I was down south. I was east. I went out west. And over and over, I would hear people say, I'll never buy another car from Detroit again. And I would say, isn't their quality just as good as the Japanese? And people would say, not the one that I owned. And I think that, first of all, it was the quality and durability issue. And second of all, you have to remember that a lot of Americans now work for companies that are owned by overseas entities. So, in fact, the publisher of my book, Doubleday, is owned by the German conglomerate Bertelsmann. You have a lot of people who travel internationally. They eat out. They eat Thai food. They eat Chinese food, Japanese food. The whole country's become a lot more internationalized, and there are certainly places in the country that are very patriotic and where people won't consider cars from the Japanese, German, and Korean companies. But I think also the fact that they have built factories in the United States has helped them a lot. I think that people who might not have bought a Toyota from Japan will buy a Toyota that's built in Kentucky. Because they can get over sort of the fact that it's a Japanese-based company by the fact that it has such a high quality rating, and they can say it's built right in Georgetown, Kentucky, so, you know, what's the big deal?
Yeah. It's really, in terms of perceptions about quality of vehicles and how they do or don't hold their value, I was really struck by this. Is an article that we came across. This was, I think, was published in Auto Week, or it came out from their online source, in which they quote something called the Automotive Lease Guide, where they found that 3-year-old Big Three vehicles that have just come off their lease, this year they retained only 39% of their sticker prices, compared, for example, with a 3-year-old Honda Accord that is worth half of its original sticker. And in this article, it's just sort of staggering. It talks about the fact that there are some customers who owe more on their auto loans than the vehicles are worth.
Yeah, that's a condition that's called upside down.
Right.
And one of the reasons why 0% financing and some of the longer car loans are so popular is that people go in and they think they can trade in their car, and then they get a trade-in amount, and they say, wait a minute, you know, you're telling me that my car is only worth $8,000. I've got $12,000 left on my loan. So people have to borrow the extra $4,000 and fold it into the price of the new car if they want to buy something. That's an issue that is very, very thorny to Detroit, and I think that they've tried to argue the whole our quality is as good as theirs. And I think there are a lot of surveys like J.D. Power that do show that coming out of the factories, the quality measurements are the same. The difference is in reliability and durability. And one of the most interesting things to me is how smart car buyers are. And, you know, 20 years ago, there were a few people who read Consumer Reports. There were people who read the car magazines. But by and large, nobody had access to information about cars and durability and how they would hold up. And now the internet has put that within the reach of anybody with a computer. And I think the fact that the internet has allowed people to check resale values, they've allowed them to check incentives, they've let them sort of check the cost of ownership over 4 or 5 years, that in a sense has worked to Detroit's disadvantage, because the numbers are there. And it's hard to argue when you go on, say, in Edmunds.com and look up 5 different vehicles and compare it across the bottom. You know, people are making up their minds based on a lot more than, you know, they used to say that Detroit sold the sizzle and now the steak. I would argue that what people are buying on now is, more importantly, the steak.
Mm. You were talking a little bit earlier about the example of the minivan, about how, at least for a while, Chrysler was doing really well, and that then it was a Honda. They said, well, we can build a minivan, and really a good one, and that the engine, I remember, it is Honda, right?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. I want to make sure I get my right company.
That's right, yeah.
That the engineer, that the guy who designed it came to the United States and spent a lot of time thinking about it and said, we're going to build the best minivan on the planet. And I guess that's, you know, you wonder, I'm sure that in Detroit they have a lot of very smart people, good designers, automotive engineers, who if they wanted to could build the best cars on the planet. You know, that there's no question that they're smart enough. Why don't they do it?
Well, I agree with you. I think some of the most talented people in the auto industry work in Detroit. I think one of the differences is the way these companies are organized. And let me give you an example. When I visited Toyota, I heard constantly about the Toyota way and also about the Toyota production system, which is a very prescribed way of designing, developing, and manufacturing vehicles. It isn't just the factory. It's everything that goes into a Toyota. That's been in effect since 1954. Honda has something called the Honda Way, and the Honda Way was created by Mr. Honda, Soichiro Honda, who only died 10 years ago. So you have very, very sort of, you have a broad understanding in those companies of the way things are done. And further, those companies are run by manufacturing experts and by engineers. In the case of both companies, both Mr. Cho at Toyota and Mr. Funo at Honda both worked in the United States. And I think that's fascinating that now the United States is considered the most important place to work to run a Japanese company. In Detroit, it's a little bit different. Two out of the three companies, GM and Ford, are run by MBAs. And basically in those companies, the finance guys, the bean counters, as they call them, have always climbed to the top. And decisions got made not so much on customer needs, but on hitting financial targets. And you would hear dozens and dozens of examples of car programs that got a little way along, and then the company would hit problems financially, and it would just send out a blanket order to suppliers to cut prices by 10%. Well, you know, at the Japanese companies, you don't do that midway through a car program. Of course you try to save money, of course you try to cut costs, but you set the budget ahead of time, and then you stick to it. And I think that that's a better way for consumers to get vehicles. And I think Detroit is changing, and General Motors has hired Robert Lutz, who is a very famous car guy, to try to instill more of a respect for vehicles into the company. But these are still, you know, companies that are permeated with finance guys and not so much what they call car guys.
We have some callers to talk with. So let's do that, starting here in Urbana, line one. Hello.
Yeah, hello. Back to Chrysler and its problems. I thought that Chrysler was now a German company.
Yes, Chrysler is owned by Daimler Chrysler, which is based in Stuttgart.
Yeah. Has that had any effect?
Well, there are some people who would argue that it slowed down what was a very efficient, very fast-moving company, because now key decisions get made back in Germany, and anything that happens in Auburn Hills up here in Detroit has to be cleared with Germany. I think Chrysler has suffered a little bit. I think they would have been in real trouble if they had to face this market as an independent company. They just didn't have the financial resources. But on the other hand, the American market is much different from the European market, and the tactics that you learn in Europe don't necessarily work here.
Yeah. Okay, thanks.
Oh, thanks. Well, what did Daimler-Benz think they were getting when they bought Chrysler, and what did they get?
A friend of mine, Bill Vlasic, is the co-author of a book called Taken for a Ride, How Daimler Made Off with Chrysler. And at the time, it was felt that the Germans sort of fooled the Americans at Chrysler, and that it was supposed to be a merger of equals, and it turned out not to be one. Well, today in Germany, they're saying that Chrysler fooled Daimler into thinking it was this healthy, fast-moving company that it really wasn't, that it was a company that was sort of had already seen its better days. And it's kind of a situation where, you know, just be honest with each other. They weren't honest about the fact that it was a merger and not a merger of equals. And on the other hand, Chrysler was about to run into a very shaky time because it just didn't have enough new products coming to keep up the sort of push that it had made in the late 1990s.
We have a caller here on a cell phone, line number two. Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
My question is, what some of the reliability factors I think about some of the U.S.-made cars is, my personal experience is we had a Toyota. It was a pretty nice car. Loved it. Never had any trouble with it at all. Zillion of miles on it. Then we got a Nissan minivan that had just all kinds of electronic stuff on it. Mm-hmm. Well, now none of the electronic stuff works, really. And it's kind of like we really don't care because it was all fluff anyway, but if somebody would ask me, I'd say the car's a pile of crud, even though basically the engine and the transmission drag us down the road just as well as the Toyota did. Is there anything to that, a perception of the difference between those cars?
Well, it's very interesting to hear you say that. I mean, it's sort of an example of how not all Japanese car makers are perfect. And certainly not all cars are perfect. It's too bad that you've had that problem. And in fact,
well, actually, Nissan is actually a Nissan valve train.
It was built in a joint venture plant with Ford. That's right.
Yeah.
that shouldn't have affected it actually. But I think Nissan would say, you know, like Detroit, that the quality of the new Quest, which is being built in Mississippi, is going to be better. That they've gotten the message. But Nissan had some rough times there in the 1990s, and there have been quality complaints about their vehicles. So I apologize to you that you had such a bad experience. I'm apologizing on behalf of Nissan. I'm sorry that you had such a bad experience just because it's your hard-earned money.
I'd like kind of your comment, too, on the difference in vehicles between, say, Europe and the United States. Mm-hmm. Why are the vehicles that are sold overseas have so much just left? I'd call it fluff in them.
Yeah, the Europeans are much more into high technology than we are. That is one of the things that sets the German companies apart from each other. And in fact, Mercedes-Benz has run into some quality issues of its own because it's loading up its cars with these new technology before the technology is necessarily tested. And so some of it isn't working, and there have been recalls and angry customers who've paid a lot of money for those vehicles. And Mercedes' response has been, well, you know, it's so technologically advanced, give us time to get it right. Well, no, I mean, get it right before you put it on sale.
I think they way underestimate the value of, you know, being able to get there and back on some of these cars is kind of my opinion of it. But, you know, just the ability to go down the road is way more valuable than how big the VCR.
Well, that's very interesting to hear you say that. Do you plan to keep this Nissan, or will you be shopping anytime soon?
Oh, we'll run it into the ground.
Yeah, yeah.
So, you know, I wouldn't have any idea what I even look for right now if I was looking for a new car. So.
Yeah, there's a lot of vehicles out there.
I'm a farmer, and I was kind of looking for a new truck, and I just really can't find anything that I really want. I kind of want something with a steering wheel and a gas pedal.
The basic stuff, right?
Exactly.
Yeah, and anything that I see, I'd be afraid to get into.
Oh, my gosh.
Because, you can't go down to your Ford dealer and buy an F-150 that's plain. It's all, it's this package or the other package or, you know, the dealer cash flow improvement package on everything.
That's right. That's one of the issues that a lot of people complain about is that they can't choose the options they want. And then once they do, if you don't buy them in a package, it really sends the price of a vehicle up pretty high. But
thanks for letting me go on. I'll hang up.
Well, sure. Thanks for
coming. Nice to talk to you. Thanks.
Well, I wanted to ask you about if you could say a few things about Saturn, because it seemed that when Saturn came along, the buzz was that this was a different kind of car and a different kind of company, and that it was they set out to do a really good job on the engineering and then also to change the way that the cars were sold to address the issues, those things that about buying a car that people said they didn't like. And I guess I wonder what now at this point the track record has been both on the vehicle and on their approach to the whole business of marketing and selling cars.
Well, I have to say I was one of the biggest fans of Saturn when it all happened back in the late 80s. It hit the market in 1990, and I just loved the idea that a company and a union could work together and make joint decisions, and that it was a clean sheet of paper approach. What happened with Saturn was that the first few years, Saturn sold extremely well. They brought in over 60% trade-ins from Toyota, Honda, even from Volkswagen. They were attracting young customers. They were attracting female customers in great numbers. But in the mid-90s, General Motors had been in a financial crisis, and they came out of it, and there was a lot of jealousy inside General Motors among the divisions over the fact that Saturn had gotten $5 billion of development money. And in particular, Oldsmobile felt that it was a 100-year-old division. It deserved money, too. And so at a very critical point in time, General Motors decided to put resources into Oldsmobile and try to save Oldsmobile, which is obviously for naught because it's gone out of business or it's going out of business. And then after that, it was time for trucks to get their due. And, you know, in the years after they tried to save Oldsmobile, they poured money into the truck development. And between 1994 and 1999, Saturn didn't get one new vehicle, which was very disappointing. There were a lot of Saturn owners coming back to Saturn and saying, okay, I had my small Saturn, now I'm ready for a midsize Saturn, or now I'm ready for an SUV, a small SUV. And that would have been the perfect place to give it a midsize car and a small SUV, say, 10 years ago. But instead, General Motors basically starved it of products so that it could feed Oldsmobile and feed truck development. Now Saturn has more vehicles, but they aren't selling very well. The Saturn View SUV is selling fine, but the car sales have really fallen off. In fact, there is, I believe, only one shift of workers on the job at the Wilmington plant that builds the bigger Saturn. And General Motors has basically, you know, taken away the independence of Saturn and folded it back into the company so that now it's just another division. And I noticed in today's paper in the Times today that there's an ad for 0% financing on the Saturn Ion, and this was a division that had promised it wouldn't have incentives, it wouldn't have dickering, it would have just a one price that everybody would pay. And so Saturn didn't really make it for more than 10 years before it just became another brand. And I think that's just tragic. I think Saturn was a real selling point, and Saturn customers would have been some of the most loyal customers that General Motors had. And I read something in Automotive News this week that when they give a minivan to Saturn, that they're going to take off those dent-proof side panels, the plastic panels, that were sort of the key selling point of all the Saturns, that you could run a grocery cart into them and they wouldn't dent. You know, and so it's all sort of been chipped away at over the years, and I think that's been a big mistake.
Let's talk with someone in Champaign here, line number one. Hello.
Hi. I was wondering if you could address future trends, such as a demand for more fuel-efficient hybrid vehicles.
Yes, I'd be happy to talk about that. I think hybrid vehicles are definitely the wave of the future, and I think that we're on the edge of seeing an explosion in hybrid technology and hybrid popularity. General Motors' head of a future product development of hybrid development said yesterday, he's the head of advanced vehicle development. Larry Burns said yesterday that hydrogen fuel cell vehicles would sort of blow hybrids out of the market and that we wouldn't need hybrids. Well, they don't have a hybrid yet, and neither does Ford. They're both planning to introduce them sometime in the next year, but Toyota's already on its second round of hybrids, and so is Honda. About 50,000 hybrids a year are sold in this country right now, but Toyota alone would like to sell 600,000 hybrid vehicles a year by 2010. And one of the ones that's coming out in the next couple of years is a hybrid Lexus RX 330 sport utility vehicle. I think once we see hybrid electric technology in larger vehicles rather than small cars, that's when we'll know if this technology is really for real. As far as hydrogen fuel cell cars go, I've actually driven one, and it's very interesting. It's very, very quiet, but you have an issue there with, first of all, they're very expensive to develop, and second, you have to have hydrogen fuel available to power them. And so we have an infrastructure problem and an expense problem. So it could be 15 to 20 years before we really see a lot of hydrogen fuel cell vehicles.
Thanks.
All right, thanks. I recall not very long ago reading a piece, and I think that this was in the New Yorker magazine, about Detroit's enthusiasm for the hydrogen fuel cell and about the way that these companies are saying, oh, well, that's the wave of the future and not this hybrid stuff, and we ought to go right to hydrogen. And it seemed that at least the person who was writing this article, the point they were making was the reason that Detroit is so enthusiastic about the hydrogen fuel cell is that it's so far away and that it means that in the meantime, they can just continue to go on making, selling the cars that they do.
Yeah, big SUVs and pickups.
Yeah, exactly. You know,
There's something to be said about that. I think, first of all, if we do have hydrogen fuel cell vehicles from Detroit, the government will pick up some of the bill. I'm completely convinced of that. Whereas in Japan, they already exist. In fact, Honda has already sold hydrogen fuel cell vehicles to the city of Los Angeles. So they're already on the road. And second, I really think that, somebody somewhere along the way will say, nobody will pay for this, this is too expensive, and we won't get customers to buy it. But you know who's the most upset about all of this is Robert Stempel, who's the former CEO at General Motors, who is now involved in hydrogen fuel cell development. And he believes that General Motors could have been out ahead of everybody else had they embraced this technology and gotten some vehicles under development.
We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. And once again, our guest for this hour is Micheline Maynard. She covers both the auto and airline industries for The New York Times. She teaches, she's a lecturer on the global auto industry at University of Michigan School of Business, and is the author of a new book. If you're interested in reading about what's happening with the auto industry in this country, the book is titled The End of Detroit, How the Big Three Lost Their Grip on the American Car Market. It's just recently out, published by Doubleday. We have a number of callers here. We'll go next to Bloomington, Illinois, line two. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Yeah, your guest mentioned Automotive News, which is the trade publication of the auto industry, and I also read that. And a few weeks ago, they had a frightening article that Wall Street really expects the U.S. auto industry to go the way of the American textile and the steel industry. And this is a tragedy of monumental proportions. We're not dealing with an industry that produces, you know, a few items that are not required and employs a few hundred workers. We're dealing with an industry that employs hundreds of thousands of unionized workers. And I'm wondering what your guest thinks about the consequences for the industrial Midwest of a terminal decline in the U.S. auto industry. Let me say also that I think Detroit, the executives themselves, are to blame for much of the decline of the industry. After World War II, the United Auto Workers, and Walter Reuther in particular, said, you know what kind of a car Detroit ought to build for a growing suburban America? It's a car that would subsequently be known as a Honda Accord. And Detroit executives said to Reuther, mind your own business, we'll build the cars that we know how to build and that we want to build that the American public wants. And Detroit subsequently went on to build the biggest, most wasteful gas guzzlers, stressing styling, tail fins, and so on, rather than engineering and practicality. And as a result, when the Honda Accord and the VW Beetle and the Toyota Camry and Corolla came on, Detroit was hopelessly behind. They never were able to catch up, and they still cannot build a small car the way the Japanese can. And it's a tragedy for the industry and for the hundreds of thousands of workers in the automobile industry. I'd like to hear what your guest has to say about that.
Well, sure. Can I ask you, first of all, what do you drive? Do you mind saying?
I drive a Nissan Maxima.
Yeah, that's one of the best cars made. That's a great choice. It's very interesting to hear you call because you're right in the territory of the Mitsubishi plant.
Right, we are.
Which is organized by the UAW because it was part of Chrysler. And that is considered to be one of the most efficient factories in the United States. I believe it's able to build five different vehicles, and in fact, Mitsubishi and Chrysler are going to be sharing development of small cars, and I think they're going to be built right in that plant. And this kind of brings up my point, is that, yes, I agree with you, it is a tragedy for the American Midwest, but what it's not a tragedy for is A, consumers, and B, the American South. Because what has happened, and one of the things I write about, is the development of this whole second American automobile industry, which has some of the most efficient plants, most skilled workers, most productive output, some of the finest quality vehicles. They're not being built in Detroit or necessarily the heartland, but they're being built in the South. They're being built in sort of the central Midwest. And no, it does not offset the jobs lost by Detroit in any way, shape, or form. The new plants are hiring roughly half of the number of workers that the Detroit plants used to hire. They are paying the same wages. They're not paying UAW-level benefits, and that's one of the things that is, I think the wages are keeping the UAW out of those plants, and they've also gone to right-to-work states as well. I think that I would tend to agree with you in part about Detroit executives because really they've had 25 years to see this coming. I graduated from school in the early 80s, And the first vehicle that I bought was a Toyota Tercel. Actually, I owned a Dodge Dart in college, but it died at 177,000 miles. I bought a Tercel. My brother bought a Corolla. Now my parents own a Passat and a Lexus, and they were lifetime Oldsmobile owners. And even they got tired of the quality, you know, disappointing them all the time. And they saw that my brother and I never had any trouble with our vehicles except to take them in for oil changes. People have asked me, what can the Midwestern states do? And I think at this point, if you go down south and you talk to people in Alabama and you see what they're willing to do to get a plant down there, you talk to Toyota about why it went to Texas instead of building another plant in the Midwest. I mean, these companies are able to go anywhere they want, and these states are stepping right up, and they're offering all kinds of incentives and road improvements and other spiffs to get people down there. And, you know, it may have been a lost battle for the Midwest at this point.
Right. Yeah, you mentioned that the transplants are paying UAW wages, but they're paying UAW wages to keep the UAW out. Mm-hmm. If the UAW goes down in Detroit, those transplants are not going to be paying UAW wages anymore.
Well, at this point, you know, I don't think that the UAW is going to go down with Detroit. I think there's still some shrinkage that'll go on. I don't think it's going away completely. But I do think that, you know, in a way, the presence of the UAW, ironically, has helped workers in these new plants get that level of wages. I cannot foresee a day, honestly, when the big three all go out of business and there's no UAW. I mean, that would be awful for the country. It would be awful for the Japanese companies and the Europeans, too, because they would be blamed for this. And I think that we'll be at a point where Detroit will shrink and the imports will grow, but at some point this has got to even out.
We just have a couple minutes left, and I'm sorry we have the lines are all jammed up, and we can't we can't take all the callers we have. We're going to try to go at least one more. The caller in Clark County, that's line number one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I drive an older Mercedes diesel. I have about 300,000 miles on it. I have absolutely no trouble with it. It was built in Germany. When the time finally comes that I replace it, I plan to replace it with another Mercedes. But I have a concern about the quality of the Mercedes that will be built in the United States. Do you have any opinion of that?
Well, I don't think it's so much a quality issue of the vehicles built in the United States. One of the things that Mercedes hasn't done with the vehicles built in Alabama is that M-Class Sport Utility that's built down there is badly in need of an overhaul. It's been on the market now for 6 years, and other SUVs have kind of passed it by. You know, I'll be honest with you, there have been some concerns about Mercedes quality, and especially since the merger with Chrysler, that rather than pull Chrysler up, people worry that it's pulled Mercedes down a little bit. Are you planning to buy a sedan? What are you thinking about replacing it with?
A four-door family car. I don't have any need for an SUV. I don't want one.
Those are all still built in Germany. So if you were to go out to get the E-Class or the S-Class, you would be replacing it with a German-built car. And especially if you want a diesel again, it will come from Germany.
Oh, good. I didn't know that. The diesel has been very economical.
Oh, yeah, people with Mercedes diesels just love them. That's a fine car.
Yeah,
I think one thing you should do is just keep reading consumer reports and go on the Internet and check quality reports around the time that you buy your vehicle just to make sure you're getting what you're really looking for.
Yeah, well, I'm going to just keep driving until this thing quits. And at 300,000 miles, it doesn't seem to be inclined to do that. Thank you very much.
Good luck to you, sir.
Well, we're going to finish up here. Just, again, as a way of rounding out, you know, we talked way back at the beginning that you made some predictions. Among them is that by the turn of the century, or by the end of the decade, by 2010, one of the big three will not continue in its present form. What do you think that, in another 6 years or so, the U.S. auto industry is going to look like?
Well, I think we're going to end up... You know, people have said, will we shrink to the big two? And I think we could easily end up with a big one where you have a General Motors that's 20 to 25%. Then you could see sort of a middle three. You could see Toyota, Chrysler, Ford, all relatively, I mean, Chrysler would be probably smaller than both Toyota and Ford. Then you would have Honda, possibly Nissan, and then everybody else is going to carve everything else up. So rather than, and in fact, the title of my book, The End of Detroit, really refers to the fact that it's the end of the Detroit in capital letters that was this concrete dominating force of the auto industry in the United States. I think that collectively Detroit will have less influence in the future, but I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing for car buyers. I think what it's going to mean for them is a lot more choices and higher quality, and it will be very, very exciting to be going out and buying vehicles in the future.
Mm. So what kind of car do you drive?
I have a Lexus RX 300, which is called the ladies SUV because three quarters of them are sold to women. It's a sport utility that's based on the chassis of the Toyota Camry, and it gets a little bit over 20 miles to the gallon. And I bought it after I had a Volkswagen New Beetle, which I loved, but which took premium gasoline and which had a turbocharged engine that continually misfired and parts that had to come from Mexico or Germany. So I kind of learned my lesson about, you know, drifting into the wrong vehicle.
Yeah. Well, thanks very much for talking with us. We appreciate it.
It's been my pleasure, and I appreciate all the calls, too.
Right.
Thank you.
Our guest, Micheline Maynard, she covers the automobile and airline industries for the New York Times. In addition, she also teaches. She's a lecturer on the global auto industry at University of Michigan School of Business. She makes her home in Ann Arbor, and she is the author of a book, The End of Detroit, How the Big Three Lost Their Grip on the American Car Market. It's published by Doubleday, and it's just out. So if you're interested in reading it, you can head down to the bookstore and look for it.